On Friday, a student at the end of the hour left with me a note. It's not a question, but I would like to read it to you and respond to it. I recognize, he wrote, my limitations of being only a young student, and thus I probably have no basis upon which to criticize you, but I offer my thoughts nevertheless. I did not take 408, but it seems as though there is no structure to this section of the course. It's almost as if you are just rambling on, going from one topic to another, an introduction to the Bible, to the realms of the world, to God's sense of justice. Many people seem to be in a state of semi-sleep. The ideals of man are just barely distinct to me at various points. Would it be possible to tell us what you are trying to show in each lecture, then explain it by examples and logic? I guess a sort of topic sentence idea is what I can't find in the lectures. Well, now, I dare say that some of you share this feeling with this student. I've been aware of it. It's nothing new to me. I run into this every year. And I don't blame the student. I'm grateful to him, as a matter of fact, for having taken the trouble to put it on the table, as it were, rather than keep it under the rug. I want to respond to it. I want to explain to you what it is that I am trying to do, and the difficulties that are inherent in the undertaking. When we move away from the Bible and we have before us a small book containing a number of Socratic dialogues of Plato, or we have the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius or Thomas More's Utopia, my approach would be quite different from what has been in my dealing with the Bible. Each of these books, almost any book that you are familiar with, is written by a person, an author, who has one lifetime within which to accomplish what he's doing. We know his years, we know his environment, we know a good deal about him, and the material is of a limited scope, so one can address oneself to it. When we come to the Bible, it's a totally different matter. You look upon it as if it were one book. It's put between the covers of a book. Actually, the Bible consists of a whole library of books. There are different ways of counting the number of books, but in our setting, the conventional way of counting them is to assign 39 books to the Hebrew Scriptures. By their own count, in Judaism, there were only 24 or 22, but any Bible today in English shows 39 books, 14 in the Apocrypha, 27 in the New Testament, giving a total of 80 books, each one presenting its own problems. Trying to take them all together and talk about the Bible. And there's the article the, it is one thing, complicates the problem no end. The vintage of these books runs the span of, according to some reputable authorities, the oldest strand may go back to 1750 B.C. The most recent would be, in the New Testament, approximately 150 of our present era, running a span of approximately 2,000 years. within which what we call the book has been written. Written by many different hands, in different settings, at different times, in different languages, Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, in the Greek that was used for the Old Testament, in the New Testament, came from the Septuagint version, which goes back to 300 or 200 years before the Christian era. The quotations in the New Testament are in Greek and not in the Hebrew, which complicates problems no end. Now, still, despite all of these difficulties, the Bible has meant a great deal to countless millions of human beings. So we're trying to get some insight into it. It's not possible to treat this book in the same way in which I will treat Thomas More's Utopia or the dialogues of Plato. It just isn't possible. Now, I could try to bluff. I could try to say this or that in simple sentences and let it go of that. But that would be totally wrong on my part. I couldn't possibly do it. I wouldn't venture to do it. I've got to try to show you the thing in its complications. The complications reflect a phenomenon. And I can't simplify it to the point of where I would say, there's this point and there's that point, points 1, 2, 3, and 4, and say, that's it. So I bear with you, I understand your problem. I haven't any doubt of it that many of you do have a problem. You would like to put down in your notes that this or that about this or that and get through with it. And I give you all kinds of sentences with all kinds of qualifications, all kinds of glosses and emendations, and I don't make the point. I certainly don't make the point in any simple way. So try to bear with me too. My problem is at least as great as that of as yours. I go through this every year. It takes a lot out of me. I try to make it as clear as I can, but within all my own human limitations, what I achieve may not be much, but at least give me credit for trying to do the job. Now, if I may, just to finish up what I was saying on Friday, since I'm coming to a conclusion on that discussion before I pick up another aspect of the Bible. The whole point about man, this is, I believe, the way the Bible has meant things to people. The whole point about the Bible in this respect is that the Bible does face up to the fact that the world is full of hatred, of strife, of evil, of cruelty, of mischief, that things are not beautiful, or life is not operated on the level of justice and goodness. Evil does flourish, and righteousness does suffer. But still, despite all that, life is meaningful. Now, why is it meaningful? It's meaningful because one can rise above the world as one sees it and say, this is the world of appearance. I have another world in which I live at the same time. In that world, I try to see things from, as it were, within a lot of allowances, a lot of limits, God's point of view. I live in relation to God. There I am happy, there I am blessed. And from that point of view, life is meaningful. Man has dignity. Man is not like the dog or the ant. His life is like grass that withers, but he himself is not like grass. He is a man. And the emphasis on man's dignity is something that doesn't always come out in express words, as very little of anything comes out in express words. This takes us back to Auerbach's point about the lacuna that exists and how one has to read into the Bible. And that's what people have done from the very beginning. It has been a major industry for a large portion of mankind to deal with the Bible, to concern itself with the Bible. Once in a while, there is an express statement about this human dignity. Of course, in Genesis, God making man in his own image, and not elaborating on this, not explaining it, but the rest of the Bible is the commentary on that, is the explanation. But in Psalm 8, there's an express statement. I want to read it to you because there's a similar statement that is made in other civilizations, as we'll see when we read Sophocles, when we read Socrates, Plato. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. When I look at thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast established, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And the Son of Man, that thou dost care for him. And then it goes on. Doesn't stop there. Yet thou hast made him little less than God. Now the word in the Revised Standard Version is God. In the King James Version, it is angels. Yet thou hast made him little less than an angel. But the Hebrew says God. But the concept was too daring for the translators of the King James Version. They didn't dare to translate the Hebrew, which is very plain, and say, yet thou hast made him little less than God. But the more recent versions all go back to the Hebrew, and they say exactly what the text says, the original. Yet thou hast made him little less than God, and dost crown him with glory and honor. Thou hast given him dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. A very poetic and very beautiful statement of man's dignity and role in the world. What is man? On the one hand, when the psalmist, as it were, by implication, takes into consideration the world that he sees. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the Son of Man that thou dost care for him? He's no better than a lot of other animals in the world. But then he catches himself and he moves away from one level to another level, which of course is typical of what happens in the Bible. A constant shift from one level of meaning to another level of meaning. When he moves away from the realm of appearance, he sees man in a totally different context. Now, all of this discussion respecting man having the capacity to live a life that is blessed by choosing life rather than death, by choosing the blessing rather than the curse. If he chooses the blessing, then he is blessed. If he chooses the curse, then he is cursed. It all assumes the radical liberty of man. It has to do that. And there's so much in the Bible that points in this direction. Man is free to choose the blessing or the curse, life or death. Nobody will do it for him. He must do it himself. Now, at the same time, there is the condition of man. It would be so much, we think, and of course foolishly think, that if life were differently organized, if justice reigned supreme, if evil were completely crushed, then life would be so much better. But that wouldn't be the life of man. Man then would have no choice. If a man were to be punished for the violation of the laws of God every time he violated that law, and he were punished right there and then, so that the execution of the law would be as revealed as the law itself, then there would be no moral law. The moral law would become like the law that operates in nature, in the physical world. We know that if you put your hand in a fire, your hand will burn. Well, if you knew that if you put your hand in another man's pocket, your hand would wither, then you would no more put your hand in the other man's pocket than you would put your hand in a candle that is lit. You just wouldn't do that. If a person were to die, if he committed adultery, if he were to do it, die in the act, well, who would do that? This would be a form of suicide. So nobody would do it. The whole point of morality is that you can get away with murder. If you couldn't get away with murder, there'd be no morality. We would be like the animals. We don't judge an animal from the moral point of view. We don't think that the dog has the liberty to do or not to do. We don't talk about his freedom of choice, his freedom of the will, his obedience of a moral law. So if you think it through, the only way you can have morality, have the concept of a moral law, have the possibility of choosing one thing or another, it must be on the principle that justice will often be defeated, that evil will often be victorious. Not always, because if it worked that way too, if always righteousness were defeated, if always evil were victorious, then there would be again the operation of a kind of a physical law. Sometimes it succeeds, sometimes it doesn't, whichever it is, whether it's evil or whether it's the good. And it's this uncertainty about the execution of the moral law which makes possible for the existence of the concept of human dignity. There's a man who can choose between good and evil. He knows the distinction. And in some sense, he is made in the image of God, who is also free, who also knows. Man knows, and man is free. And so the Bible is full of incidents in which righteousness is defeated. As I told you, Naboth was killed. No problem about, no question about that. Abel was killed. You can go through from beginning to end, and you will find that this is what happens constantly. Not always, again, as I say, you have to catch yourself. And we know in our own lives that this is the way things are. And one of the reasons for the greatness of the Bible in its appeal is that it does not pretend that life is different from the way it is. Now, at the same time, the human heart has its desires. We pray for the vindication of the just, of the righteous.
Oh, if not in our time, we project a Messiah, a messianic period, a millennium, when things will be straightened up. Of course, we don't think it through, because supposing the Messiah comes, and evil is completely wiped out, will man be man? What will be the difference between him and an angel? An angel cannot choose. I mean, the conception of an angel. Man will not be able to choose. Will he be man? But of course, we don't penetrate these mysteries beyond a certain point. They are an expression of a fundamental human desire for a better life, for a better organization. And this, of course, is the drive of the Bible, of biblical man, to improve, to right wrongs as often as he can, but at the same time not to pretend that he is God and that he's achieving the ultimate. Yes. How much is ready to what? Oh, well, the story about Adam and Eve, that's a very difficult problem. You have to try to understand it as a symbolic idea, some kind of a myth. It's the Bible found it hard to express in ordinary terms how man became man. I think the story of Adam and Eve tries to say that at some point in his development, man became the kind of man we were talking about, where he could choose between good and evil and live a life in which he has to face constantly the problem of a choice between good and evil. How that came about, well, the Bible doesn't tell us. Again, you go back to the point made by Auerbach. It provokes commentaries. And the commentaries on Adam and Eve are literally beyond count. So this is where we're left. You're free to speculate on that. It's not a matter of a dogma as far as the Old Testament is concerned, the Hebrew Scriptures. You can believe whatever you like about what happened. Give it the kind of meaning that'll make most sense to you. But it does try to suggest the idea that at some point, the human condition, as we refer to it in our common language today, came into existence. At one time, man was, in a state of nature, to use a more modern conception. He was beyond good and evil. But at some point, he faced up to the reality, the challenge of the choice between good and evil. And since then, life hasn't been the same for man. Yes? Am I saying that God created the world what? Without a moral law? Oh, no, I'm not saying that. No, God judged Cain. God judged Cain. God judged Noah's generation. Well, he couldn't have judged them unless there were a moral law that was operative. So he judged them under the moral law. Would you mind speaking up so I could hear you and the rest of the class too? What about the best of all possible worlds? Yeah, what about it? Well, the explanation, yes, that from the religious point of view is that the answer to this problem of whether or not, as Leibniz put it, this is the best of all possible worlds, yes. The world in which there is the challenge of evil is better than a world in which there would be no challenge and men would not be men. This is the religious answer to that question. Well, let me try now to move over to a totally different aspect of the problem, but not unrelated to it. It's different, but as you'll see, the relations are there, but it's an approach from another point of view. And this is a discussion of biblical time and biblical history, the sense of time and history that many scholars have uncovered in the Bible. And this is an extremely important way of looking at some of the problems that we've been discussing. The Bible introduces a sense of time and a sense of history which was unique in the ancient world and that has become the modern sense for Western civilization, the modern sense of time and history for Western man. It'll take me a little while to explain this, but I think it's an extremely significant aspect of the problem. In the Old Testament, there is a more or less straight line of movement. It starts with creation and moves along to you've read Genesis, so this is familiar to you. To Adam and Eve. And Abraham and the covenant. And then the Exodus. And the Exodus takes in Sinai and the Promised Land. They're all related concepts. We use the term Exodus to incorporate what in the Hebrew Scriptures is the central point of this line of history. At some point or other, the kingdom in the Promised Land is destroyed, but a remnant remains, and the promise that there would always be a remnant. And then an indefinite line that goes on, that has gone on now for 2,000 years since the destruction in the year 70 to the coming of the Messiah, which would be the end time, as it is sometimes spoken of. There would be a new man, new Adam, new life, and a complete reordering of life. Now, this is the way it is related in the Hebrew Scriptures. The New Testament accepts all this. Would you mind, please? The New Testament accepts this. But it goes on. The New Testament says the Messiah has come. Jesus is the Christ. Christ is the Greek for the Hebrew, which is Mashiach, which is the Messiah transliterated. So, in a sense, there was an end time achieved. A man can, as it were, be a new Adam already now. There is a new remnant, which is the church, which is Christianity, Christendom, or sometimes spoken of as the new Israel. All the Old Testament prophecies have already been fulfilled, the prophecies that pointed to
to the coming of the Messiah and the substitution of the church as the new Israel or the new remnant for the original remnant, which was Israel, and the second coming. Which would be, again, the end time. This is the eschatology as it is spoken of. The new Adam, the new life. The importance of this for us is in many ways to be expressed. Each event is unique. There is no repetition. There is no return. There is a going on.